history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are always some stories there that should not go untold. The problem is, they may very well go untold if we don't take the time to ask a few questions and patiently listen to what comes back our way. The idea is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but if we're really paying attention, I think often we'll end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation and the powerful perspective they provide. We've been in kind of a different mode during this coronavirus pandemic. I'm sure I don't have to explain to you that, in general terms, the men and women who share their stories on this program are part of the most vulnerable age group when it comes to COVID-19. In light of that, I've been reluctant to schedule face-to-face meetings with vets out of an abundance of caution. Instead, we've spent most weeks lately examining 75th anniversaries of things that were unfolding in the final year of World War II. Earlier this week, President Donald Trump issued a statement on the 75th anniversary of the end of the Battle of Okinawa, a massive 82-day engagement in which more than 12,000 Allied troops were killed. Today, we're going to hear the memories of two men whose experiences 75 years ago this week are echoed in that presidential statement, which pointed out that of the 1,300 American ships involved, 26 were sunk and 168 more damaged. In total, the battle cost more than 200,000 lives, including the tragic loss of nearly 100,000 Okinawan civilians. You're going to hear an example of that today as well. And I'm going to go ahead and read some of that commemorative statement. The grueling struggle on Okinawa lasted 3 months and consisted of multiple battles both at sea and on the island. American and Allied troops had to navigate treacherous terrains, including cliffs and tunnels. They valiantly rose to the challenge, demonstrating the bravery and resolve that have always defined the men and women of our armed forces. In total, presidents awarded 23 medals of honor to true American patriots for their gallantry and courage during the 82 days of fighting on the island. Today, the president said, "We remember our greatest generation and salute those who answered our nation's call with unyielding valor and intrepid resolve. As our country continues to recover from the unprecedented hardships we have faced over the past months, let us draw from their patriotism and conviction in our efforts to build a stronger, more united country for all Americans." So those were the words from the White House this week. Now for the words of men who lived that reality on and around Okinawa firsthand. The USS Curtis had been bombed by the Japanese at Pearl Harbor at the outset of the war. On June 21, 1945, the seaplane tender was again the victim of a Japanese attack. But this time, it was no surprise. Bill Mills and the rest of the sailors on the Curtis knew kamikaze attacks off of Okinawa had intensified.
Yeah, we were thinking about those all the time. We knew we were going into that area, too, and we went, so that was getting pretty close to Tokyo, or Japan, rather.
Well, and this is where kamikazes were the thickest and the most active was off of Okinawa.
Right.
So you guys know when you're headed that way that this is a possibility.
Yeah.
And again, you're not going to see it coming. You're not going to know what's going on.
No.
Well, tell me about it. June 21st, 1945. What do you remember about that day?
The main thing I remember, I guess, that we were in general quarters most of the time. You know, it might let up for just a short time and finally go up on the deck. Finally, I tuck a blanket down and just sleep on that diamond plate steel rather than try to go back up the ladder and back down again. So, yeah, about 2 or 3 days there around that time where we were in general quarters most of the time.
So the days leading up to June 21st, you knew kamikazes were in the area.
Right.
And you're just pretty much on nonstop.
Right.
So you must have been pretty tired. Must have been worn out.
Yeah, I made a note there one place that I kept a little ledger on it. But I made a note there one time I slept an hour and a half.
Let's see if I can read your writing. June 21, 1945, in port at 1842, that's 6:42 p.m., got hit
I can't read it either. So.
Well, it hit by Japanese dive bomber. NGQ most of night, except for a few minutes at a time. Captain Peck was relieved by Captain Doan.
About two hours and something before.
Yeah, 2 hours and 42 minutes before the ship was hit.
Right. So he was off to a bad start.
So this was the captain of your ship?
Yeah. He had just changed captains just before we got hit.
Well, I'm sure there's a lot more to this story than what I just read, that at 6:42 p.m. you got hit by a Japanese dive bomber. Where were you when that happened?
I was in the engine room already because, like I say, we were at GQ most of the time, so I happened to be down there.
And what did that feel like down there when that plane hit?
It felt like the ship bounced off at the bottom and came back up like a cork or something, the way it felt. I knew we were hit.
Did it throw you off your feet?
Oh, yeah, it shook you up a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And then the ship started to list, naturally, you know. So as it would list, I'd pump water into, or fuel, whichever, into another tank on the other side, and I'd level it off. And about the time you got it level, all the water would shift, and you'd go back the other way. So it was kind of nip and tuck for a while.
Yeah, and probably a lot of people wouldn't even consider that that's how you deal with that situation. So you're in this boiler room. The ship's listing to one side, and if you don't do this right in moving the water around from tank to tank, your ship could sink.
Yeah, it just keeps listing, you know, if you don't pump water to a tank on the other side. So.
And had you ever practiced that before?
I hadn't had the occasion to do that.
How'd you know what to do?
I'm not sure. Somebody told me or I figured it out, one or the other.
It's a good thing you did.
Yeah.
And is that just you doing that? Did you have some other guys helping you?
I had other guys down there, but I, you know, just one guy on the open valve. Well, I had someone to open the valve, you know, or close it.
And how long do you think you had to keep doing that before the ship straightened out?
Oh, it's been so long. It's been about 75 years, so. But it was quite a while. Then there was a seagoing tug came alongside and tied on, kind of propped us up, you know, and.
But those had to be some scary moments for you.
Well, they were scary.
Did you think you guys were going under?
No, I didn't think so. I mean, I didn't have time to think that we were or weren't.
Yeah.
I was just doing my job, you know, trying to figure out which way to pump that water.
And you had to go back and forth a few times, right? Because
right.
It was listing one
right.
way and then the other?
Right.
Yeah. That sounds tense enough to me.
Till we got the seagoing tug alongside, you know, and kind of stabilized us.
And was that night that the tug came along?
Yeah, within a few hours, the tug was there. It must have been close by. And there was another ship, too. They sent a crew aboard to weld a border plate over the hole where there's about a 5x8 gap in the hole, I think.
Well, this is what the Navy said a couple months later when they finally told everybody what happened to you. They said the seaplane tender USS Curtis's fighting power survived at almost maximum strength the crash of a Japanese suicide plane and its 1,000-pound bomb last June near Okinawa, although 35 men were killed and 21 wounded. The kamikaze's delayed-action bomb rammed through to the center line of the Curtis before exploding immediately over a bomb stowage magazine, which miraculously escaped detonation.
That's the part that... Or somebody is looking out for us.
I guess so. How is that possible?
I don't know. It don't sound possible to me.
So
but it happened.
Where this bomb went off was right next to bombs that you guys were carrying.
Yeah.
But somehow they didn't go off.
Somehow they didn't.
Whew.
Yeah, I think the good Lord was looking out for us.
Hard to argue with that.
Yeah.
Is that something you believed at the time? That you thought the good Lord would be looking out for you? Or is that just something you see in retrospect?
Yeah, it's just something I see in retrospect.
Uh-huh. So the bomb hits. Somehow it doesn't set off the bombs on your ship, but it does kill more than 35 men. I think later they said 37?
Yeah, something like that. Obviously, heard two or three different counts, uh-huh. But somewhere around 35.
Were there guys that you knew that were killed that day?
I didn't know them too well because it was out of the engineering department.
Uh-huh. If your ship had gone under, do you think there's any way you would have survived?
It's hard to know.
Given where you were. You're kind of trapped, aren't you?
Yeah. Yeah, kind of trapped if it comes in above.
So you're in there in the boiler room, pumping it back and forth to keep the ship afloat. At what point did you realize the extent of the damage that had happened up above?
Oh, I didn't know for a while, because I was still in general quarters. So it was later that they announced that we were secure, So.
So then what did you have to do?
Stop shaking, I guess.
Well, I'm sure you had a job with relation to cleaning up the damage.
Oh, yeah.
Right? What'd you have to do?
Wasn't much damage in where I was in the boiler room.
Right.
It hit the sick bay and different area in the bomb storage, but it didn't really do any damage where I was, except shake you up a little bit. So just a little cleanup,
But I can't imagine that was an easy job.
No, it wasn't an easy job.
You probably saw things that you'd never seen before.
Oh, I did, yeah. So anyway, we survived.
Yeah. But you probably saw a lot of guys who didn't survive. Like, you probably saw what was left of them.
Right. Yeah. It's not a pretty sight. I guess that's why I filed these papers away in the closet and I didn't even think about that was another life. Mm.
You really haven't talked about it these last 70 years.
Not too much, no. If somebody asks me, I'll tell them.
Did you tell your kids about it growing up?
Not very much till they were grown.
Well, this gives a little more description of it from this official Navy record. It says the Curtiss was operating in the southern Ryukyu's Islands near Okinawa when the kamikaze struck at dusk of June 21, 1945. The Japanese plane took advantage of the gathering darkness and concealment of neighboring islands to approach within 800 yards before he was sighted by lookouts aboard the Curtiss. The plane struck on the starboard side amidships at an estimated speed of 400 knots. The engine, part of the tail assembly, and the heavy bomb ripped through the skin of the ship, opening two gaping holes and exploding on the third deck. The terrific explosion wiped out the sick bay spaces, together with the warrant officer's mess room, staterooms, officer's galley, library, photo lab, barber shop, and post office. Choking smoke gushed from the damaged area and flames licked through four decks above the point of the explosion. Fire mains and sprinkler systems in the blasted area were ruptured, and the firefighting crew brought emergency extinguishing equipment to bear. At this critical stage, however, the main propulsion engines were operative, and the Curtiss could have proceeded at moderate speed. Also, gun crews standing at general quarters stations against further air attack and all guns operative except the forward 5-inch battery. With the fires out of control, there was imminent danger of the flames reaching the bomb stowage magazine, the upper ammunition handling rooms, and adjacent magazines. During this critical period, many acts of individual heroism were observed. When it became apparent that a great volume of water was needed to control fires in the Curtiss, two salvage vessels and two ocean tugs came alongside to assist. These small ships, under grave danger from threatened explosion of the Curtiss's magazine, remained alongside for more than an hour, pumping heavy streams of water onto the burning compartments. The Shackle sent a combat fire team aboard the Curtiss to cut their way with torches into a compartment in which a dangerous fire was burning. With flames under control, the ship's force turned to, with little rest, to clear away the debris and pump out flooded magazines and compartments. Then a service force repair crew came aboard to weld a boilerplate on the 5-by-8-foot gash in the hull. The ship was prepared to proceed. In reporting the action, the commanding officer credited the cool efficiency of the entire ship's company in the face of great danger with saving the ship and reducing casualties to a minimum. Sounds like a pretty big deal.
Yeah, it was a big deal to me.
These other ships, by coming to your aid, were risking themselves. All those guys were risking their own lives.
Right, because we could have had an explosion in there any time, and they were gone too. So.
Yeah, not only was it miraculous that the Japanese bomb didn't set off your bombs, but these fires are still burning. They could set off all kinds of stuff.
Right, that's what I mean.
And where that Japanese plane, where the damage stopped, was four decks down. Are you right below that?
Yeah, I guess I was just below it. I was at the bottom point, really. Just the bilge is all what left underneath me. So
if it had come down a little further, it blows you and everything up.
Yeah, it would.
And this fire's going for a while. Did you see any of that fire or the smoke?
No, I didn't. Like I say, I was in my battle station in the boiler room. I am glad I didn't see it.
And your commanding officer credits the whole ship with saving the ship. That means you. What you were doing down there in the boiler room helped save the ship.
Yeah, I suppose.
How often have you thought about that over all these years?
Not too much. I mean, I figured, well, I made it, so why worry about it now? Some people weren't so lucky, so there's a lot of people died. One thing I regret, my ship went into Tokyo Harbor. I rated Liberty, and I could have gone ashore, but I didn't want to. I regret it now. I didn't want to see them. I didn't want to face them or something.
So in retrospect, you wish you would have gone off
right,
and looked around a little bit?
Because I've never been to Japan.
Why was it you were so upset with Japan? Was it just that they had started this in the first place, or that they had hit your ship?
Or? I think so. And all the buddies that had died, you know, and all that stuff. So I didn't have a good feeling for them. I was finished.
And for decades, Mr. Mills really didn't discuss his experiences in World War II. In his case, as it has been with many veterans in recent years, an honor flight to Washington, D.C. brought some of those memories to the surface. And sharing that honor flight experience with so many other veterans gave him the courage to talk about it.
Well, I thought it was great, but I just feel like I was being treated as a hero, and I wasn't a hero, you know. I just did my job.
Well, if you hadn't done your job as well as you did it, there might have been more guys who didn't come home.
Yeah, that's another way to look at it.
Including you.
including me.
What were the things about that trip, the things that happened on that trip, that made you feel that way, that they were seeing you in that light?
Everything, I guess. I mean, there was someone waiting on you, taking care of you. You didn't have to. And then a lot of these places I would have never seen, you know. So I really appreciate it.
You had a few people that wanted to shake your hand?
My hand hasn't rested up yet.
What do they say to you?
Most of them say thanks, you know, and stuff like that. When I came back into Fresno, there's some of those ladies were even crying, you know, as they had tears in their eyes as they'd shake your hand. So I thought that was something.
I bet they did more than shake your hand. I bet you got a few kisses on the cheeks.
I did. That was a highlight.
And I bet you had a whole lot of your family waiting for you.
Yep, that's for sure. That was great.
And the band playing and people waving red, white, and blue and right. Cheering for you.
Yeah, and the way the traffic gave you the right-of-way on the buses and stuff like that, that was amazing.
You know, I've had a lot of veterans tell me that. One of the things they were most impressed by was having a police escort around Washington, D.C.
Yeah, that impressed me, for sure.
Make you feel like you're somebody.
Right. Maybe I am a hero.
I think there's a lot of people that would say that. And I asked you earlier about getting mail from home. Did you get some mail on that flight? Did they hand you some letters on the way home?
Oh, yeah, that was something. Wasn't those kids? That brought tears to my eyes, you know, that they'd go to all that trouble.
People you've never met before are writing you letters and saying
right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And what about being there in Washington? I know you saw a lot of things. You saw the changing of the guard at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, and you saw all the names on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall, the haunting Korean War Memorial, and those soldiers marching through the rice paddy. But what about being at the World War II Memorial and taking all that in? Here you've got a pillar for Oklahoma, your native state, and one for California, the state that you've lived in for all these years. And then there's that wall of gold stars. 406,000 Americans were killed in World War II. What did you think about while you were looking at that?
I was just thinking it was a big waste, and hope we don't have to do it again.
Did the thought enter your mind how close you came to being part of one of those stars?
No, not really. I guess I figured I made it, so why worry about it now, so, or something.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm just curious, too, if while looking at that big wall of gold stars, and it says underneath, here we mark the price of freedom. Did your mind go to any of the people you knew who died in World War II?
Just the crew, mostly, my ship.
Yeah, 36 guys who were killed with that kamikaze.
Yeah, and the Pearl Harbor, too. I mean, the Pearl Harbor, that bothers me, the Pearl Harbor.
Because it was a surprise attack?
Yeah.
You remember feeling that before you went in the service?
Yeah, I was ready to go back and pay for it.
I know it was a long way away at the opposite end of the war, but the way the Curtis was hit on December 7th was very similar to the way it was hit on June 21st, 1945. A Japanese plane with a bomb crashing into the ship.
That's right.
And who knows how close you were to being entombed in the boiler room of the Curtis.
Oh, yeah. Or he could have hit by the boiler room, so.
You would have never known what hit you.
I'd never known.
Well, I don't want to belabor that point, but I do want to join all those people who shook your hand on the honor flight and said, thank you for serving our country. Thank you also for telling us a little bit about it. Is there something that you'd say, you know, most of us alive today weren't alive during World War II. We didn't hear about Pearl Harbor on the radio. We didn't go through rationing. We certainly didn't go overseas and get shot at or get kamikazed off of Okinawa. What do you think is important for us to understand today about what happened then and what all you guys went through and why you did what you did?
Just hope it don't happen again, I guess.
Do you think America was different then than it is now?
Well, I think so. I don't think America would do that now. I don't think they'd come together like they did in World War II. People are too divided in opinions.
You said something a little while ago. Who do you see as the heroes of World War II?
Actually, I see the heroes as the guys that are out there in front with the Marines and the attacks. That's the heroes. That's where you're going in face-to-face with these guys. To me, they're heroes.
Well, we are going to hear the memories of one of those men he was describing when we come back. That was Bill Mills. And about the same time his ship, the USS Curtis, was dealing with that devastating kamikaze attack off of Okinawa, thousands of Allied troops were in the final days of fighting on Okinawa. One teenage Marine brought home something that always reminded him of the reality of war. Hear about that special keepsake when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. 75 years after the conclusion of the 82-day Battle of Okinawa, we are reliving through the memories of men who were there, things that were unfolding at this very time in 1945. We're going to hear what a teenage Marine named Dale Anderson experienced there, but first a little background on how he ended up in the Marines. It wasn't exactly what he had planned when he and two friends went to join the military together.
The last thing my father told me, said, "Son, whatever you do, don't let them put you in the Marine Corps." He had been in the Army in World War I in the cavalry, and he knew the Marines were a dangerous part to be in, so he advised me that. But anyway, I argued with the Marine recruiter for about 30 minutes, and he said, "Well, I got to leave for a little bit. Think it over." So I thought it over, and I knew he was going to put me in the Marines whether I wanted to or not. So when he came back, I said, "All right, I'll go." So they put me in the Marines, they put Art in the Army, and Jack Taylor put him in the Navy. So they really split us up there.
So much for the best laid plans there. So you're in the Marines now. I guess they had to whip you into shape. Was that a tough job for you, or were you already in pretty good shape from all that work you'd been doing?
Well, I was in good shape, but it was still Marine Corps boot camp at San Diego was so hard for me because I was only 5'4", weighed 140 pounds, and here I was in there with 6'4", 6'5" guys. And when you're marching, trying to keep up with guys that's got that long of legs, I almost had to run all the time. And it was really hard. We were right next to the air base down at San Diego there. And we had one sergeant. His name was Sergeant Learn. He talked like he gave his commands like he had a mouthful of hot mush. He was hard to understand, and with the wind blowing, I caught one time I didn't hear his command, and I marched right up to the fence joining the Air Force down there with the Marine base. And I was standing there marking time, afraid to look around because they had these what they call swagger sticks. And we had the old pith helmets, and they'd come down over your head with a swagger stick and that pith helmet on. It sounded like a bomb went off on your head. And when I finally, after 2 or 3 minutes, I finally got brave enough to kind of look around, and there the platoon was all down about 50 feet behind me, waiting on me. And so when I got back in ranks, he said, "Flynn, take that man's name. He'll do extra duty this afternoon." And so boot camp was really, really hard. I remember one time we went to Chow, and of course they run a lot of men through there for breakfast. I had a frog in my throat, so I kind of got it up and spit on the pavement. The sergeant saw me, so that afternoon we went out where it was sandy, and he set the platoon down and said, "Anderson, take your little shovel that you have and start digging." So I dug down to where I could just barely look out over the top of it, and he said, "Now spit in it." And of course, my mouth was so dry, I couldn't spit, but I made the motion, and he said, "Now cover it up." And he said, "Now let that be a lesson to you and all the rest of you men that if every man came down for breakfast here, spit on the pavement, nobody'd be able to stand up." And so that was one of the hard things. And every day they'd march us around and tell us what all we could be shot for. And it's amazing what you can be shot for when you're in Marine Corps boot camp.
Sounds like they put the fear of God in you.
Oh, they did. They did. It was really hard. But I'm really proud to be a Marine because... like I told, I was teaching Sunday school class one day up at Dunlap Baptist Church. I said, "Marine Corps boot camp helps me every day of my life." I said, "You don't see any hair on my bar of soap." Because when they had inspection, if they picked up your bar of soap and saw a hair on it, you probably scrubbed the toilet with your toothbrush that afternoon. And so I heard a little chuckle in the back of the room, and I said, what's that?" And some lady says, "You don't see much on your head either." We were in the 62nd replacement draft when we went over, and they were needing we heard later that 9 out of 10 of us that were going over in those replacement drafts were being killed at the time. But they left us on Guam for about 30 days, and then we headed on toward Okinawa.
Now, before we get to Okinawa, you mentioned 9 out of 10 being killed, and at this point, I mean, you're in the Marine Corps, and I'm sure you've heard about what's happened to the Marines at places like Tarawa or Guam or Iwo Jima, even more close to what was happening then. Was that intimidating? Did that cause some fear in you, knowing what could happen to you?
Yes, it caused fear, but it kind of also gave us more determination to go get the job done.
All that price that had already been paid in this war, that it wouldn't be worth anything if you guys didn't finish the job? Is that kind of what you're saying?
That's right. That's what we were thinking, yes.
So what did you know about this place called Okinawa?
Not a thing. Not a thing, except that it was really well fortified. We had heard that, but we didn't know much about it. About a day before we got to Okinawa, a kamikaze plane came at our ship. The Navy and the Marines always kind of jaw against back and forth against one another, but I always really liked to hand it to the Navy boys because they were able to shoot that kamikaze plane out of the air, and it landed about a block from our ship. Otherwise, probably I wouldn't be telling this story.
And by this time, the kamikaze phenomenon had been practiced for a while by the Japanese, so you guys knew what that plane's intent was. Did you actually see it heading for the ship?
Oh, yes, we sure did. I sure did. Yes, I saw it heading for the ship. And that was a pretty scary moment for us. But we were so rejoicing, and a cheer went up through the whole ship when they were able to shoot it down so it didn't get our plane. It landed in the ocean and then blew up as it landed. So I was really thankful for that.
And that's a lot closer call than most of us can relate when it comes to military experiences, but you were in for some more close calls once you hit land there at Okinawa. Tell us about coming onto that island and what you encountered.
The northern half of the island was secured, and we landed toward the southern half of the island. Naha City was one of the big cities that was there close. As we came in the LST boats, he didn't get quite far enough in the shore, I guess because of the coral reef. But anyway, as I stepped off of the edge of the boat, of course I had my pack and my weapon, And I sank all the way under. I could not touch the ground. And had it not been for a couple of big 6'4" guys catching me under each arm and taking me in about 20 feet before I could even touch the ground, I'd have probably died right out there before I even got into battle. But we didn't take any fire as we were going in on the beach, but they loaded us in trucks and started taking us inland because the battle was raging inland. As we just kind of started out down this dirt road, kind of going uphill, I looked over the side and I saw just a half of a body laying in the trench from the rib cage up. And we had a sergeant with us, Sergeant Ferguson, that had been over there before. This was his second tour. And I said, "Sarge, I just saw a piece of a body laying there." And he said, "You're going to see a lot of those from here on in." And he was right. Before we went in another probably mile, it was just getting dusk, and there must have been at least 20 of those half of bodies. It seemed like that the Japanese, when they were knew they were going to be captured, they would blow themselves up, and that was because of those bodies laying along there. And they took us in that night, and they bedded us down under about 8 or 10 10-inch guns, big guns, booming all night long. And they bedded us down under there, and they said, "You don't move from here tonight. If you got to go to the bathroom, just roll over and go. But if you get out of your sacks, you're liable to get shot before morning." And so we stayed close. We didn't get much sleep, but that was when we went in on Okinawa there.
And shot not by the Japanese, but by your own guys, thinking maybe you were Japanese coming into your camp. So you're 18 years old. You're on this island halfway across the world from where you grew up, and you've seen pieces of bodies everywhere. You're hearing these booming guns. What are you thinking that night as you try to get some sleep?
I was thinking, I sure hoped we had good guards that was standing guard duty, because every once in a while, you'd hear of a guard going to sleep. So I couldn't really sleep soundly, and I still don't, because I was always afraid that a guard might go to sleep instead of standing his post.
So that was the first night. You've seen some of the effects of this battle, of this war that cost so many lives worldwide, but you haven't experienced it all firsthand just yet. I imagine you didn't have to wait very long.
No. I think the next night or two, as we marched on in from there, one night, in fact, that's what I got the sword here from, the souvenir. We were in our foxholes, and we had heard that the Japanese were going to make a banzai attack on our unit. We thought we were ready, but just about dawn, we heard them making a lot of noise. They were getting all doped up and everything. They tell us that they got, I don't know what kind of dope they used, but they got dope where they couldn't feel much pain. But they came at us with their swords hollering, "Banzai, Banzai." And, of course, we were started firing at them. And I wasn't aiming. I was just firing from the hip at this one big the Japanese were big on Okinawa. They were big Marines. But anyway, I kept firing. I thought somebody had maybe given me blanks for my weapon because he wasn't falling like he should have. But finally, he fell right at the edge of my foxhole, and I got his sword here laying on the table. But that was a scary time. We did repel the whole Japanese unit there, kill most of them, but they were pushed back.
How difficult was that? To go through that experience as a teenager?
It was very difficult back then, but it brings back, it brings back tears to my eyes now, because when I think about it and think how close I come to getting my head lopped off there, and some of the other guys that got killed, none of them got their heads taken off, but some of them were killed with the swords. But it is difficult, but it's so important that we pass this history on, so hopefully we never have another war like we had back then, or any war, for that matter of fact. History is so important to our younger generation.
If you can, put yourself in your mind then as an 18-year-old. How did you get beyond that the next day? Because that's enough to weigh someone down and really cripple them with just the weight of what was happening there. What do you think it was that helped you get through it and get on to another day?
Well, looking back on it, I think it was God that was directing and guiding this, even though I didn't know Christ at the time, but he brought me through it. But it was hard. I remember one morning we were going to chow. The mess hall was up on the hill. The island was almost secured at the time. I was passing by this small two-man tent, and I heard this explosion. One of my good buddies came crawling out on his hands and knees out of the tent, and there was a stream of blood about the size of your index finger shooting out his right temple. Every time his heart would beat, it would just and of course he died there in just a matter of seconds. And the other fella named Gil Belcher, he was about 6'6" tall, and he came out of the tent all bent over, but he was running and screaming, and he just ran in a big circle out, and the guys had to catch him to hold him down. I thought that they had been playing with a landmine and it went off. But that's not the case. One of them was cleaning his rifle, and as he pushed down to putting his rifle back together, he pushed down on a landmine, and that's what exploded. And he had like 170 pieces of shrapnel. He lived, but he got to come home, but he lived through it. But I didn't go on to breakfast. It made me sick at my stomach when I saw that blood pouring out of his head there. So it just spoiled my appetite that day.
What our veterans endured then and what our men and women in uniform sometimes face today, we should never take for granted. It's break time again, but when we come back, the special reminder that teenage Marine Dale Anderson brought home with him from Okinawa after a tragic situation that was unfolding 75 years ago this week. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, getting a taste of some of the things unfolding in and around the island of Okinawa 75 years ago this week. You heard 1st Marine Division veteran Dale Anderson discussing some of the hazards faced by the young men fighting there. He was only 18 at the time. One of the other common injuries was self-inflicted, at least for those carrying the M1 Garand rifle.
Well, when you pull the breech of the M1 back and you insert a clip of 8 rounds of ammo, you push it down in there, and to get the breech to go forward, you have to kind of pull back with your thumb or your little finger, pull back on that and push down the ammo down in hard with your thumb, and as you let go of the breech, it will move forward, locking it in.
It's spring loaded there, so it goes in a hurry. Yeah.
Yeah. If you don't get your thumb out of there, it'll smash your thumb, and that's what you call M1 thumb. They showed us that in boot camp, but when we were up on the firing line, several of the fellas got that because they didn't get their thumb out of the way fast enough.
So you never had to deal with it? You never got your thumb caught in there?
No, I never got my thumb caught in there.
I'm glad for you that you didn't. I have a feeling that I probably would have done it too many times. Might not have a thumb still today.
Talking about the M1, when the last round was fired from the clip would spring out, and it makes a very familiar sound as it springs out. And the Japanese were aware of that sound, and they knew you had to get a new clip in your weapon. And so when they heard that sound, they would take advantage of that and try to attack you before you could get another clip in your weapon. The island had a lot of big caves. There was a lot of bags of black powder ammo left around from that. And as we would go out on patrol, one day we were walking down this dirt road, and there was sugarcane on each side of the road. Sugarcane was up about 5 feet high, and we would always walk about 8 feet apart in case somebody lobbed a grenade over into our ranks. It wouldn't kill that many. One day, this Sergeant Ferguson, he carried a 30 caliber carbine. He just turned and fired, and about a few seconds after he fired, we heard this thud. Just after we heard the thud, here came pieces of blood and guts and everything and landed on us, and we didn't realize what had happened real soon, but Fergie said a Japanese had raised up ready to throw a grenade over in our ranks, and that's when he saw him and he shot him. The Japanese fell, and when he fell, his grenade went off, and that's what threw that blood and guts all up around over us. We went on down from there, this same sergeant, now where it was grass on each side of the road, high grass, about almost 3 feet high, and there was a dry canal running down along, and there was a big willow tree down on the side of that. As we approached that willow tree, Fergie just turned and fired in the grass, again with his 30 caliber. He had sharp eyes, but he turned and fired, and a woman fell out. He had shot her right down through the top of the head. All he saw was black hair at the time he shot. He didn't know it was a woman, but he shot her right down through the top of the head, and the bullet came out her left cheek, blew it out. And just almost immediately after that, two big Japanese was running down this dry canal. Of course, they were both killed almost immediately. Then we went up to the tree and went down, and there was a cave about 3 or 4 feet in diameter. And if you came to a cave that had flies flying around the mouth of it, you knew it was occupied. We had a Okinawan that was friendly to us that we took along as an interpreter. So we sent him into the cave to see if there was anybody in there to try to get him to surrender and come out. And in just a little bit, this old grandma, she must have been 80 or better, and about a 10-year-old girl came out. Of course, they both had their hands up. The little 10-year-old girl had this little doll in her hand. And she bowed and she held out the doll to me, and I made the motion that I didn't want it, but she did it again, so I took this little doll, and I've had it all these years. They were sent to a repatriation holding camp, but it's hard memories.
When you saw a grandmother and a little girl handing you a doll, did that alter your perspective or put more of a human face on what was going on there on Okinawa?
We knew they couldn't hurt us, or we didn't think they could hurt us, so we were sympathetic toward them because we figured it was probably a whole family that had been wiped out that day. This was probably the grandmother, and the first lady that Fergie killed was probably the mama of the little girl, and then the two that was running down the ditch that got killed, they were probably her sons or her brother. And so it was a whole family that was probably wiped out that day. That's just hard when you think back on it.
Yeah, it seems like that's part of the explanation of what you said earlier, that you hope there's never another war like the one you guys were in.
Yes, sure is.
So this Battle of Okinawa, the last major land battle of World War II, did you have any kind of inkling when it was winding down that things might be over for you soon?
No, we were still, we were preparing for mainland Japan, and we were all dreading that battle. Even though we were Marines, we were dreading the Battle of mainland Japan because the way Iwo Jima had been fortified and Okinawa had been fortified, we knew mainland Japan was going to be really, really bad. I always had to hand it to President Truman at the time for making the hard decision to drop the atomic bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. That was a mighty hard decision he had to make.
By mid-August, Japan is surrendering, and you guys don't have to go over there, and I imagine you Marines celebrated just a little bit.
Yeah, we celebrated a lot with some Japanese sake. One kind of fun thing that we had, it was July, the island was secured, so I had brought in a bag of this black powder with granules about the size of your index fingernail. I decided I'd have a little fun. Of course, we were drinking a little sake at the time, too.
This wasn't just being stupid. You knew how to work with black powder from your days blowing up giant trees in the forest for lumber back before the war, right?
That's right. Yes, that's we did. I'd had some experience with black powder and dynamite. And we used to buy our dynamite from a place there in Orange Cove. I think the little building is still there where they kept the dynamite out back.
So when the 4th of July rolls around on Okinawa, you want to celebrate like all your fellow Americans back home. You find some black powder. What kind of fireworks did you produce, and how'd you pull it off?
Well, I found a pipe, a 3/4-inch pipe, about 3 feet long. We were bivouacked right along a river there, and so I stuck this end of this pipe down in the edge of the bank, kind of pointed it out over the river, and filled it with black powder and whittled me out a wooden plug to go in it, but I didn't have a fuse. I didn't have a way to set it off. And it was getting toward dusk. I looked over about 100 feet or so, and we saw a column of gnats about 4 foot high and about a foot around that was just static. And I thought, well, that's strange to hear, to see gnats flying around in a static position. So I said, well, let's go investigate. So a couple of buddies and I, we went over. It was an old house that had been all blown to pieces. We threw back some boards. Here was a big crock with about an 8-inch mouth on it, and it was almost 3 feet deep, buried in the ground. And, of course, these gnats were flying right over the top of that. And I got to thinking, well, I know gnats like vinegar, so maybe it's a jug of vinegar. So I took my canteen cup and dipped down in it and smelled of it. Don't smell too bad. So I tasted of it. Ooh, it even tastes even better. So it was a whole jug of Japanese sake. So I filled both canteens. Of course, the canteens were aluminum back then. I filled both canteens, went back to camp, tore off a piece of my shirt, dipped it down in it, stuck it down in the pipe, let the end of it come over and stuck a match to it, and it burnt down in that black powder, and those big granules of black powder came out over that river just real pretty, nice.
Lit up the sky?
Lit up the sky. And I was getting ready to load up again. I kind of looked down by where the pipe was, and I saw these two shoes. They must have been size 14 or 16. They were, I think, the biggest boots I'd ever seen. And I slowly looked up, and it was a captain. He said, Anderson, what are you trying to do? And I said, oh, just have a little fun, sir. It's 4th of July. And he said, your fun is over. He said, we thought we were under, the officers were bivouacked upon the hill. And he said, we thought we were under attack again. So you quit that. So the next day, we were out on patrol, and I decided I'd have a drink of water out of my canteen that I'd filled last night. And so as I pulled that aluminum canteen out of the canteen cup, the whole bottom of that canteen came off. It was just disintegrated from that Japanese sake. And so you can imagine what it would do to your stomach.
Exactly. And I hope none of you listening got any 4th of July ideas from what he did on Okinawa 75 years ago. After occupation duty in China, Dale Anderson finally got to come back to the States. But that journey was not without incident either.
We hit a typhoon coming out of the Yellow Sea there in China, and I always got seasick the first couple days out. I'd get terribly sick, and that day I was so sick I didn't care whether I lived or died. It was just so sick, and they'd put us back on the aft of the ship, and there was about 20 of us back here in the same condition, and we were just sliding back and forth in our own vomit or in everybody's vomit, and they'd come along about every hour with a big fire hose and hose us down. The ship was listing so much, and if it had another 2 degrees of list, it would have probably sunk. It took us 21 days to come home nonstop. Going over, we went over on the USS Pickaway, which was a troop transport. It wasn't a real large ship. As we sailed around the Hawaii coming home. We were on our last leg of the journey. It was beautiful moonlight nights, and the porpoises were running along the ship, jumping. I remember that as the most enjoyable time of my service was on the way home. I left San Diego, and I came back to San Diego.
And grew up quite a bit in between after going over as a teenager. When you think back about your time in the service, and you mentioned earlier how important it is to you that this history is not lost and that that your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids know what happened then, what would you share with the rest of us that you think we ought to know and remember about World War II and the men who served in that time?
I would like to see every able-bodied young man and young lady go through Marine Corps boot camp or a boot camp, and just remember that war is hell. There's no glory in war, and when you see your friends and your buddies killed and wounded and maimed, just remember that, as the old saying is, I think history can repeat itself. We don't want to ever repeat World War II in our nation, and so do your part in keeping America strong and safe. I came home from the war all one piece and went up to Mineral King, which is east of Visalia, and started logging up at Silver City, and got between two logs end to end, mashed my knee. They took me to Fresno Community Hospital and waited 10 days and amputated below the knee, trying to save the knee, and that didn't work, so they waited another 10 days and amputated above the knee. Still didn't hit enough blood, they thought, and they were going to have to go higher. And that night I promised God that if he'd let me keep that much leg, that I would faithfully serve him. And I've tried to do that through these 60 some odd years. But that's how I lost my leg.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it occurs to me that maybe that circumstance that could be really devastating for a lot of people, and I'm sure was really challenging for you, maybe your experience in the war and the things you had to deal with as a young Marine prepared you for going through something that severe?
Yes, because this injury to me wasn't near as severe as some that I had seen during the war, and so I felt myself really lucky, or maybe blessed, that that's all that happened to me, that I just lost a leg.
Remember when I said that we can gain some powerful perspective when we listen to these stories and what some of these Americans were dealing with 75 years ago? I don't know about you, but that's exactly what happened for me today. If you would like to link to the full-length original interviews with the two veterans whose memories you heard today, you can do that at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for spending this hour with us today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.